Renaissance painter might draw on a church wall. No beginning, no end. The circle hung in the air for a while. All done. Having said this, the girl stood and undid her bath towel. Completely naked, she stayed there for a while, as if allowing her damp body to dry naturally in the still air. It was a lovely sight, the smooth breasts, the lower abdomen free of pubic hair. She bent over and picked up the pajamas where they had fallen on the floor, putting them on directly next to her skin without underwear, buttoning the top and tying the bottom's cord. Tengo watched all this in the darkened room, as if studying an insect undergoing metamorphosis. Tengo's pajamas were too big for her, but she looked comfortable in them. Fukaeri slipped into bed, found her narrow space, and rested her head on Tengo's shoulder. He could feel the shape of her little ear against his naked shoulder and her warm breath against the base of his neck. All the while, his paralysis began to fade, just as the tide ebbs when the time comes. The air was still damp, but no longer unpleasantly sticky. Outside, the insects were beginning to chirp. By now, Tengo's erection had subsided, and his penis was beginning to sink into the peaceful mud again. Things seemed to have run their course, bringing the cycle to an end. A perfect circle had been drawn in the air. The animals had left the ark and scattered across the earth they craved, all the pairs returning to the places where they belonged. "You'd better sleep," she said. "Very deeply." "Sleep very deeply," Tengo thought. "Sleep, and then wake up. What kind of world will be there tomorrow?" "No one knows the answer to that," Fukaeri said, reading his mind.
Chapter 15. Aomame. Time now for ghosts. Aomame took a spare blanket from the closet and laid it over the man's big body. Then she placed a finger on the back of his neck again and confirmed that his pulse had completely stopped. This man they called Leader had already moved on to another world. What kind of world that was, she could not be sure, but it was definitely not 1Q84. In this world, he had now become what would be called the deceased. The man had crossed the divide that separates life and death, and he had done so without making the slightest sound, with just a momentary shiver, as if he had felt a chill. Nor had he shed a drop of blood. Now he had been released from all suffering, lying silent and dead, face down on the blue yoga mat. As always, her work had been swift and precise. She placed the cork on the needle and returned the ice pick to the hard case. This went into the gym bag. She took the Heckler and Koch from the vinyl pouch and slipped it under the waistband of her sweatpants, safety released and a bullet in the chamber. The hard metal against her backbone reassured her. Stepping over to the window, she pulled the thick curtain closed and made the room dark again. She picked up the gym bag and headed for the door. With her hand on the knob, she turned for one last look at the large man lying in the dark room. He appeared only to be sound asleep, as he had when she first saw him. Aomame herself was the only person in the world who knew that he was no longer alive. No, the little people probably knew, which was why they had stopped the thunder. They knew it would be useless to go on sending such warnings. The life of their chosen agent had come to an end. Aomame opened the door and stepped into the bright room, averting her eyes from the glare. She closed the door soundlessly. Buzzcut was sitting on the sofa drinking coffee. On the table was a coffee pot and a large room service tray holding a stack of sandwiches. The sandwiches were half gone. Two unused coffee cups stood nearby. Ponytail was sitting in a rococo chair beside the door, his back straight, as he had been earlier. It seemed as though both men had spent the whole time in the same position, saying nothing. Such was the reserved atmosphere that pervaded the room. When Almame came in, Buzzcut set his coffee cup onto its saucer and quietly stood up. "I'm through," Almame said. "He's asleep now. It took quite a while. I think it was hard on his muscles. You should let him get some sleep."
"He's sleeping?"
"Very soundly," Almame said. Buzzcut looked Almame straight in the face. He peered deep into her eyes. Then he slowly moved his gaze down to her toes and back again, as if to inspect for possible irregularities.
"Is that normal?"
"Many people react that way, falling into a deep sleep after they have been released from extreme muscular stress. It is not unusual." Buzzcut walked over to the bedroom door, quietly turned the knob, and opened the door just enough to peer inside. Almame rested her right hand on the waist of her sweatpants so that she could take the pistol out as soon as anything happened. The man spent some 10 seconds observing the situation in the bedroom, then finally drew his face back and closed the door.
"How long do you think he will sleep?"
he asked Almame.
"We can't just leave him lying on the floor like that forever."
"He should wake up in 2 hours or so. It would be best to leave him in that position until then." Buzzcut checked his watch and gave Almame a slight nod.
"I see. We'll leave him like that for a while," Buzzcut said. "Would you like to take a shower?"
"I don't need to shower, but let me change my clothes again."
"Of course. Please use the powder room."
Almame would have preferred not to change her clothes and to get out of there as quickly as possible, but she had to be sure not to arouse their suspicions. She had changed clothes when she arrived, so she must change her clothes on her way out. She went into the bathroom and took off her sweatsuit and her sweat-soaked underwear, dried her body with a bath towel, and put on fresh underwear and her original cotton pants and blouse. She shoved the pistol under her belt so that it would not be visible from the outside. She tested various movements of her body to make sure that they would not appear unnatural. She washed her face with soap and water and brushed her hair. Facing the large mirror over the sink, she twisted her face into every scowl she could think of in order to relax any facial muscles that had stiffened from tension. After continuing that for a while, she returned her face to normal. After such prolonged frowning, it took her some moments to recall what her normal face even looked like. But after several attempts, she was able to settle on a reasonable facsimile. She glared into the mirror, studying her face in detail. "No problem," she thought. "This is my normal face. I can even smile if I have to. My hands are not shaking either. My gaze is steady. I'm the usual cool Almame." Buzzcut, though, had stared hard at her when she first came out of the bedroom. He might have noticed the streaks left by her tears. There must have been something left after all that crying. The thought made Almame uneasy. He must have found it odd that she would have had to shed tears while stretching a client's muscles. It might have led him to suspect that something strange had occurred. He might have opened the bedroom door, gone in to check on Leader, and discovered that his heart had stopped. Almame reached around to check the grip of her pistol. "I have to calm down," she told herself. "I can't be afraid. Fear will show on my face and raise suspicions." Resigning herself to the worst, Almame cautiously stepped out of the bathroom with the gym bag in her left hand, right hand ready to reach for the gun. But there was no sign of anything unusual in the room. Buzzcut stood in the center, his arms folded, eyes narrowed in thought. Ponytail was still in the chair by the door, coolly observing the room. He had the calm eyes of a bomber's tail gunner.
accustomed to sitting there all alone, looking at the blue sky, eyes taking on the sky's tint.
"You must be worn out," Buzzcut said. "How about a cup of coffee? We have sandwiches, too."
"Thanks, but I'll have to pass on that. I can't eat right after work. My appetite starts to come back after an hour or so."
Buzzcut nodded.
Then he pulled a thick envelope from his inner jacket pocket. After checking its weight, he handed it to Ah-Mame.
The man said, "I believe you will find here something more than the agreed-upon fee. As I said earlier, we strongly urge you to keep this matter a secret."
"Hush money?" Ah-Mame said jokingly.
"For the extra effort we have put you through,"
the man said without cracking a smile. "I have a policy of strict confidentiality, whatever the fee. That is part of my work. No word of this will leak out under any circumstances," Ah-Mame said. She put the unopened envelope into her gym bag. "Do you need a receipt?"
Buzzcut shook his head. "That will not be necessary. This is just between us. There is no need for you to report this as income."
Ah-Mame nodded silently.
"It must have taken a great deal of strength," Buzzcut said, as if probing for information.
"More than usual," she said.
"Because he is no ordinary person."
"So it would seem."
"He is utterly irreplaceable," he said. "He has suffered terrible physical pain for a very long time. He has taken all of our suffering and pain upon himself, as it were. We can only hope that he can have some small degree of relief."
"I can't say for sure because I don't know the basic cause of his pain," Ah-Mame said, choosing her words carefully. "But I do think that his pain may have been reduced somewhat."
Buzzcut nodded. "As far as I can tell, you seem quite drained."
"Perhaps I am," Ah-Mame said. While Ah-Mame and Buzzcut were speaking, Ponytail remained seated by the door, wordlessly observing the room. His face was immobile. Only his eyes moved. His expression never changed. She had no idea whether he was even hearing their conversation. Isolated, taciturn, attentive, he kept watch for any sign of enemy fighter planes among the clouds. At first, they would be no bigger than poppy seeds. After some hesitation, Ah-Mame asked Buzzcut, "This may be none of my business, but drinking coffee, eating ham sandwiches, are these not violations of your religion?" Buzzcut turned to look at the coffee pot and the tray of sandwiches on the table. Then the faintest possible smile crossed his lips.
"Our religion doesn't have such strict precepts. Alcohol and tobacco are generally forbidden, and there are some prohibitions regarding sexual matters. But we are relatively free where food is concerned. Most of the time we eat only the simplest foods, but coffee and ham sandwiches are not especially forbidden."
Ah-Mame just nodded, offering no opinion on the matter.
"The religion brings many people together, so some degree of discipline is necessary, of course. But if you focus too much on formalities, you can lose sight of your original purpose. Things like precepts and doctrines are, ultimately, just expedients. The important thing is not the frame itself, but what is inside the frame."
"And your leader provides the content to fill the frame."
"Exactly. He can hear the voices that we cannot hear. He is a special person."
Buzzcut looked into Ah-Mame's eyes again. Then he said,
"Thank you for all your efforts today. And luckily the rain seems to have stopped."
"The thunder was terrible," Ah-Mame said.
"Yes, very," Buzzcut said, though he himself did not seem particularly interested in the thunder and rain.
Ah-Mame gave him a little bow and headed for the door, gym bag in hand.
"Wait a moment," Buzzcut called from behind. His voice had a sharp edge.
Ah-Mame came to a stop in the center of the room and turned around. Her heart made a sharp, dry sound. Her right hand casually moved to her hip.
"The yoga mat," the young man said.
"You're forgetting your yoga mat. It's still on the bedroom floor."
Al-Mamis smiled. "He is lying on top of it, sound asleep. We can't just shove him aside and pull it out. I'll give it to you if you like. It's not expensive and it's had a lot of use. If you don't need it, throw it away."
Buzzcut thought about this for a moment and finally nodded.
"Thank you again. I'm sure you're very tired."
As Al-Mamin neared the door, Ponytail stood and opened it for her. Then he bowed slightly.
"That one never said a word,"
Al-Mamin thought. She returned his bow and started to slip past him. In that moment, however, a violent urge penetrated Al-Mamin's skin, like an intense electric current. Ponytail's hand shot out as if to grab her right arm. It should have been a swift, precise movement, like grabbing a fly in thin air. Al-Mamin had a vivid sense of its happening right there. Every muscle in her body stiffened up. Her skin crawled and her heart skipped a beat. Her breath caught in her throat, and icy insects crawled up and down her spine. A blazing hot white light poured into her mind.
"If this man grabs my right arm, I won't be able to reach for the pistol. And if that happens, I have no hope of winning. He feels it. He feels that I've done something. His intuition recognizes that something happened in this hotel room. He doesn't know what, but it is something that should not have happened. His instincts are telling him, you have to stop this woman, ordering him to wrestle me to the floor, drop his whole weight on me, and dislocate my shoulders. But he has only instinct, no proof. If his feeling turns out to be wrong, he'll be in big trouble. He was intensely conflicted, and now he's given up. Buzzcut is the one who makes the decisions and gives the orders. Ponytail is not qualified. He struggled to suppress the impulse of his right hand and let the tension go out of his shoulder. Al-Mamin had a vivid sense of the stages through which Ponytail's mind had passed in that second or two. Al-Mamin stepped out into the carpeted hallway and headed for the elevator without looking back, walking coolly down the perfectly straight corridor. Ponytail, it seemed, had stuck his head out the door and was following her movements with his eyes. She continued to feel his sharp, knife-like gaze piercing her back. Every muscle in her body was tingling, but she refused to look back. She must not look back. Only when she turned the corner did she feel the tension go out of her. But still she could not relax. There was no telling what could happen next. She pushed the elevator's down button and reached around to hold the pistol grip until the elevator came, which took an eternity, ready to draw the gun if Ponytail changed his mind and came after her. She would have to shoot him without hesitation before he put his powerful hands on her, or shoot herself without hesitation. She could not decide which. Perhaps she would not be able to decide. But no one came after her. The hotel corridor was hushed. The elevator door opened with a ring, and Al-Mamin got on. She pressed the button for the lobby and waited for the door to close. Biting her lip, she glared at the floor number display. Then she exited the elevator, walked across the broad lobby, and stepped into a cab waiting for passengers at the front door. The rain had cleared up completely, but the cab had water dripping from its entire chassis, as if it had made its way here underwater. Al-Mamin told the driver to take her to the west exit of Shinjuku Station. As they pulled away from the hotel, she exhaled every bit of air she was holding inside. Then she closed her eyes and emptied her mind. She didn't want to think about anything for a while. A strong wave of nausea hit her. It felt as if the entire contents of her stomach were surging up toward her throat, but she managed to force them back down. She pressed the button to open her window halfway, sending the damp night air deep into her lungs. Then she leaned back and took several deep breaths. Her mouth produced an ominous smell, as though something inside her were beginning to rot. It suddenly occurred to her to search in her pants pocket, where she found two sticks of chewing gum. Her hands trembled slightly as she tore off the wrappers. She put the sticks in her mouth and began chewing slowly. Spearmint. The pleasant, familiar aroma helped to quiet her nerves. As she moved her jaw, the bad smell in her mouth began to dissipate. It's not as if I actually have something rotten inside me. Fear is doing funny things to me, that's all. Anyhow, it's all over now. Ah, Mama thought. I don't have to kill anyone anymore. And what I did was right, she told herself. He deserved to be killed for what he did. It was a simple case of just punishment. And as it happened, strictly by chance, the man himself had a strong desire to be killed. I gave him the peaceful death he was hoping for. I did nothing wrong. All I did was break the law. Try as she might, however, Al-Mame was unable to convince herself that this was true. Only moments before, she had killed a far-from-ordinary human being with her own hands. She retained a vivid memory of how it felt when the needle sank soundlessly into the back of the man's neck. That far-from-ordinary feeling was still there, in her hands, upsetting her to no small degree. She opened her palms and stared at them. Something was different. Utterly different. But she was unable to discover what had changed and how. If she was to believe what he had told her, she had just killed a prophet, one entrusted with the voice of a god. But the master of that voice was no god. It was probably the little people. A prophet is simultaneously a king, and a king is destined to be killed. She was, in other words, an assassin sent by destiny. By violently exterminating a being who was both prophet and king, she had preserved the balance of good and evil in the world, as a result of which she must die. But when she performed the deed, she struck a bargain. By killing the man, and in effect throwing her own life away, she would save Tengo's life. That was the content of the bargain, if she was to believe what he had told her. Al-Mame had no choice but to believe fundamentally in what he had said. He was no fanatic, and dying people do not lie. Most importantly, his words had genuine persuasive power. They carried the weight of a huge anchor. All ships carry anchors that match their size and weight. However despicable his deeds may have been, the man was truly reminiscent of a great ship. Al-Mame had no choice but to recognize that fact. Taking care that the driver did not see her, Al-Mame slipped the Heckler and Koch from her belt, set the safety catch, and put the gun in its pouch, relieving herself of 500 grams of solid, lethal weight.
"Wasn't that thunder something?" the driver said. "And the rain was incredible."
"Thunder?" Al-Mame said. It seemed to have happened a long time ago, though it had been a mere 30 minutes earlier. Yes, come to think of it, there had been some thunder.
"Yes, really incredible thunder. The weather forecast said absolutely nothing about it. It was supposed to be beautiful all day."
She tried to make her mind work. "I have to say something, but I can't think of anything good to say. My brain seems to have fogged over."
"Weather forecasts are never right," she said.
The driver glanced at Amame in the rearview mirror. Maybe there was something funny about the way she spoke.
The driver said, "I hear the water in the streets overflowed and ran down into the Akasakamitsuke subway station onto the tracks. It was because the rain all fell in one small area. They stopped the Ginza line and the Marunouchi line. I heard it on the radio news."
The concentrated downpour brought the subway to a stop. Will this have any influence on my actions? I've got to make my brain work faster. I go to Shinjuku Station to get my travel bag and shoulder bag out of a coin locker. Then I call Tamaru for instructions. If I'm going to have to use a Marunouchi line from Shinjuku, things could get very messy. I only have 2 hours to make my getaway. Once 2 hours have gone by, they'll begin to wonder why Leader isn't waking up. They'll probably go into the bedroom and discover that he's drawn his last breath. They'll go into action immediately.
Do you think the Marunouchi line is still not running?
Amame asked the driver.
I wonder. I really don't know. Want me to turn on the news?
Yes, please. According to Leader, the little people caused that downpour. They concentrated the intense rain on the small area in the Akasaka district and caused the subway to stop. Amame shook her head. Maybe they did it on purpose. Things don't always go according to plan.
The driver tuned the radio to NHK. They were broadcasting a music program, folk songs sung by Japanese singers popular in the late 60s. Having listened to such music on the radio as a girl, Amame remembered it vaguely, but in no way fondly. If anything, the memories it called up for her were unpleasant ones, things she would rather not think about. She put up with it for a while, but there was no sign of news about the subway situation.
"Sorry, that's enough. Could you please turn off the radio?" Amame said. "I'll just go to Shinjuku Station and see what's happening."
The driver turned off the radio. "That place will be jammed," he said. As the driver had said, Shinjuku Station was horribly congested. Because the stalled Marunouchi line connected with the national railways here, the flow of passengers had been disrupted, and people were wandering in all directions. The evening rush hour had ended, but even so, pushing her way through the crowd was hard work for Amame. At last she made her way to the coin locker and took out her shoulder bag and her black imitation leather travel bag. The travel bag contained the cash she had taken from her safety deposit box. She took the items out of her gym bag and divided them between the shoulder and travel bags. The envelope of cash she had received from Buzzcut, the vinyl pouch containing the pistol, the hard case with the ice pick. The now useless Nike gym bag she put into a nearby locker, inserted a 100 yen coin, and turned the key. She had no intention of reclaiming it. It contained nothing that could be traced to her. Travel bag in hand, Amame walked around looking for a payphone in the station. Crowds had formed at every phone. People stood in long lines waiting their turn to call home and say they would be late because the train had stopped. Amame put her face into a light frown. "I guess the little people are not going to let me get away that easily. Leader said they can't touch me directly, but they can interfere with my movements through the back door using other methods." Amame gave up on waiting her turn for a phone. Leaving the station, she walked a short distance, went into the first cafe she saw, and ordered an iced coffee. The pink payphone here was also in use, but at least it had no line. She stood behind a middle-aged woman and waited for her long conversation to end. The woman flashed annoyed glances at Amame, but resigned herself to hanging up after she talked for 5 more minutes. Amame slipped all her coins into the phone and punched in the number she had memorized. After 3 rings, a mechanical recorded announcement came on. "Sorry, but we can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message after the beep.
The beep sounded, and Ah Mama said into the mouthpiece,
Hello, Tamaru. Please pick up if you're there.
Someone lifted the receiver, and Tamaru said, I'm here.
Good, Ah Mama said.
Tamaru seemed to sense an unusual tension in her voice.
Are you all right?
He asked.
For now.
How did the job go?
Ah Mama said, He's in a deep sleep. The deepest sleep possible.
I see, Tamaru said. He sounded truly relieved, and it colored his voice. This was unusual for him.
I'll pass on the news.
She'll be glad to hear it.
It wasn't easy.
I'm sure it wasn't.
But you did it.
One way or another, Ah Mama said.
Is this phone safe?
I'm using a special circuit.
Don't worry.
I got my bags out of the Shinjuku Station coin locker.
Now what?
How much time do you have?
An hour and a half, Ah Mama said. She explained briefly. After another hour and a half, the two bodyguards would check the bedroom and find that Leader was not breathing.
An hour and a half is plenty, Tamaru said.
Do you think they'll call the police right away?
I don't know. Just yesterday, the police went into the group's headquarters to start an investigation. They're still at the questioning stage and haven't launched the investigation itself. But it could be real trouble for them if the head of the religion suddenly turned up dead.
You think they might just handle it themselves without making anything public?
That would be nothing for them. We'll know what happened when we see tomorrow's newspaper, whether they reported the death or not. I'm no gambler, but if I had to make a bet, I'd put my money on their not reporting it.
They won't just assume it happened naturally.
They won't be able to tell by appearances. And they won't know whether it was a natural death or murder without a meticulous autopsy. In any case, the first thing they're going to want to do is talk to you. You were the last one to see him alive, after all. And once they learn that you've cleared out of your apartment and got into hiding, they'll be pretty sure it was no natural death.
So then they'll start looking for me. With every resource at their disposal.
That's for sure, Tamaru said.
Do you think we can manage to keep me hidden?
We've got it all planned out, in great detail. If we follow the plan carefully and persistently, no one's going to find you. The worst thing would be to panic.
I'm doing my best, Ah Mama said.
Keep it up. Act quickly and get time on your side. You're a careful and persistent person. Just keep doing what you're doing.
Ah Mama said, There was a huge downpour in the Akasaka area, and the subways have stopped running.
I know, Tamaru said. Don't worry, we weren't planning for you to use the subway. You'll be taking a cab and going to a safe house in the city.
In the city? Wasn't I supposed to be going somewhere far away?
Yes, of course you will be going far away, Tamaru said slowly, as if spelling things out for her. But first we have to get you ready. Change your name and your face. And this was a particularly tough job. You must be all keyed up. Nothing good can come of running around crazily at a time like this. Hide out in the safe house for a while. You'll be fine. We'll provide all the support you need.
Where is this safe house?
In the Koenji neighborhood. Maybe 20 minutes from where you are now.
Koenji, Ah Mama thought, tapping her nails against her teeth. She knew it was somewhere west of the downtown area, but she had never set foot there. Tamaru told her the address and the name of the condo. As usual, she took no notes, but engraved it on her brain.
On the south side of Koenji Station, near Ring Road 7, apartment 303. press 2831 to unlock the front door.
Tamaru paused while Aomame repeated, 303 and 2831 to herself.
The key is taped to the bottom of the doormat. The apartment has everything you'll need for now, so you shouldn't have to go out for a while. I'll make contact from my end. I'll ring the phone 3 times, hang up, and call again 20 seconds later. We'd like to avoid having you call.
I see, Aomame said.
Were his men tough?
Tamaru asked.
There were 2 of them, and both seemed pretty tough. I had some scary moments. But they're no pros. They can't touch you.
There aren't too many people like me.
Too many Tamarus could be a problem.
Could be, Tamaru said.
Carrying her bags, Aomame headed for the station's taxi stand, where she encountered another long line. Subway operations had still not returned to normal, it seemed. She had no choice but to take her place in line. Joining the many other annoyed-looking commuters and patiently waiting her turn, Aomame mentally repeated the safe house address, the name of the building and apartment number, the code for unlocking the front door, and Tamaru's phone number. She was like an ascetic sitting on a rock on a mountaintop, intoning his precious mantra. Aomame had always had confidence in her powers of memory. She could easily memorize those few bits of information. But these figures were now a lifeline. If she forgot even one of them in this situation, it could put her survival in jeopardy. She had to make sure they were engraved on her brain. By the time Aomame finally got a taxi, a full hour had passed since she had left Leader's corpse in the hotel room. So far, it was taking her twice as long as she had planned. A delay that the little people had caused, no doubt.
No, it could be sheer coincidence. Maybe I'm just letting the specter of some non-existent little people frighten me.
Aomame gave the driver her destination and then settled back in the seat, closing her eyes.
Right about now, those 2 guys in their dark suits are probably checking their watches and waiting for their guru to wake up.
Aomame pictured them. Buzzcut was drinking coffee and thinking about all sorts of things. Thinking was his job. Thinking and deciding.
Maybe he had grown suspicious.
Leader's sleep was all too quiet.
But Leader always slept soundly, without making noises. No snoring or even heavy breathing. Still, there was always his presence. The woman had said that Leader would be sound asleep for at least 2 hours, that it was important to let him rest quietly so that his muscles could recover. Only an hour had gone by, but something was bothering Buzzcut. Maybe he should check on Leader's condition. What should he do? Ponytail was the dangerous one, though. Aomame still had a vivid image of that momentary hint of violence he had displayed as she was leaving the hotel room. He was silent, but his instincts were sharp. His fighting skills must also be outstanding, probably much more so than she had imagined until that moment. Her own command of martial arts was surely no match for his. In a fight, he would probably not give her a chance to reach for her gun. Fortunately, though, he was no professional. He had let his rational mind interfere before he put his intuition into action. He was used to taking orders, unlike Tamaru. Tamaru would subdue his opponent and render him powerless before thinking. Action came first. Trust the instincts and let rational judgments come later. A split second's hesitation, and it was all over. Recalling that moment at the door, Aomame felt her underarms growing moist. She shook her head. I was just lucky. At least I avoided being captured on the spot. I have to be a lot more careful from now on. Tamaru was right.
the most important things are to be careful and persistent. Danger comes the moment you relax. The driver was a polite-spoken middle-aged man. He pulled out a map, stopped the car, turned off the meter, and kindly found the exact location of the condo building. Ah, Mama thanked him and stepped out of the cab. It was a handsome new 6-story building in the middle of a residential area. There was no one at the entrance. Ah, Mama punched in 2831 to unlock the front door, went inside, and rode a clean but narrow elevator up to the 3rd floor. The first thing she did upon exiting the elevator was find the location of the emergency stairway. Then she removed the key taped to the back of the doormat of apartment 303 and used it to go inside. The entryway lights were set to go on automatically when the door opened. The place had that new apartment smell. All of the furniture and appliances looked brand new and unused, as if they had just come out of the boxes and plastic wrapping, matching pieces that could have been chosen by a designer to equip a model condo. Simple, functional design, free of the smell of daily life. To the left of the entry was a living dining room. Off a hallway was a bathroom, and beyond that were 2 rooms. One had a queen-sized bed that was already made. The blinds were closed. Opening the window that faced the street, she heard the traffic on Ring Road 7, like the distant roar of the ocean. Closing it again, she could hear almost nothing. There was a small balcony off the living room. It overlooked a small park across the street. There were swings, a slide, a sandbox, and a public toilet. A tall mercury vapor lamp made everything unnaturally bright. A large Zelkova tree spread its branches over the area. This was a 3rd-floor condo, but there were no other tall buildings nearby from which she might have to worry about being watched. Ah, Mama thought about the Jiugaoka apartment she had just vacated. It was an old building, not terribly clean, with the occasional cockroach, and the walls were thin. Not exactly the kind of place to which one became attached. Now, though, she missed it. In this brand new, spotless condo, she felt like an anonymous person, stripped of memory and individuality. Ah, Mama opened the refrigerator to find 4 cans of Heineken chilling in the door. She opened one and took a swallow. Switching on the 21-inch television, she sat down in front of it to watch the news. There was a report on the thunderstorm. The top story concerned the flooding of Akasaka Mitsuke Station and the stopping of the Marunouchi and Ginza lines. The water overflowing the streets had poured down the station steps like a waterfall. Station employees in rain ponchos had piled sandbags at the entrances, but they were obviously too late. The subway lines were still not running, and there was no estimate of when they would return to normal. The reporter thrust a mic at one stranded commuter after another. One man complained. "The morning forecast said it would be clear all day." She watched the news program until it ended. Of course, there was no report yet on the death of Sakigake's leader. Buzzcut and Ponytail were probably still waiting in the next room for the full 2 hours to pass. Then they would learn the truth. She took the pouch from her travel bag and pulled out the Heckler and Koch, setting it on the dining table. On the new table, the German-made automatic pistol looked terribly crude and taciturn, and black through and through. But at least it gave a focal point to the otherwise impersonal room. "Landscape with pistol," Ah, Mama muttered, as if titling a painting. "In any case, I have to keep this within reach at all times, whether I use it to shoot someone else or myself." The large refrigerator had been stocked with enough food for her to stay for 2 weeks or more, fruit, vegetables, and several processed foods ready for eating. The freezer held various meats, fish, and bread.
There was even some ice cream. In the cabinets, she found a good selection of foods in vacuum pouches and cans, plus spices. Rice and pasta, a generous supply of mineral water, 2 bottles of red wine and 2 white. She had no idea who put these supplies together, but the person had done a very thorough job. For now, she couldn't think of anything that was missing. Feeling a little hungry, she took out some camembert, cut a wedge, and ate it with crackers. When the cheese was half gone, she washed a stalk of celery, spread it with mayonnaise, and munched it whole. Next, she examined the contents of the dresser drawers in the bedroom. The top one held pajamas and a thin bathrobe. New ones, still in their plastic packs. More well-chosen supplies. The next drawer held 3 sets of t-shirts, socks, and underwear. All were simple white things that seemed chosen to match the design of the furniture, and all were still packed in plastic. These were probably the same things they gave to the women staying in the safe house, made of good materials, but very much supplied by an institution. The bathroom had shampoo, conditioner, skin cream and cologne, everything she needed. She rarely put on makeup, and so needed few cosmetics. There were a toothbrush, interdental brush, and a tube of toothpaste. They had also thoughtfully supplied her with a hairbrush, cotton swabs, razor, small scissors, and sanitary products. The place was well stocked with toilet paper and tissues. Bath and face towels had been neatly folded and piled in a cabinet. Everything was there. She looked in the bedroom closet, wondering if, by any chance, she would find dresses and shoes of her size, Armani and Ferragamo preferably. But no, the closet was empty. There was a limit to how far they could go. They knew the difference between thoroughness and overkill. It was like Jay Gatsby's library. The books were real, but the pages uncut. Besides, she would not need street clothes while she was here. They wouldn't supply things she didn't need. There were plenty of hangers, though. She used those hangers for the clothes she had brought in her travel bag, taking each piece out, checking it for wrinkles, and hanging it in the closet. She knew that it would be more convenient, as a fugitive, to leave the clothes in her bag rather than hanging them up. But the thing she hated most in the world was wearing creased clothing. "I guess I can never be a cool-headed professional criminal," Ah Mama thought, "if I'm going to be worried about wrinkled clothes at a time like this." She suddenly recalled a conversation she had once had with Ayumi. "The thing to do is keep your cash in your mattress, so in a jam you can grab it and escape out the window." "That's it," Ayumi said, snapping her fingers. "Like in The Getaway, the Steve McQueen movie. A wad of bills and a shotgun. I love that kind of stuff." "It's not much fun to live like that," Almama said to the wall. Almama went into the bathroom, stripped and showered. The hot water took off the remaining unpleasant sweat still clinging to her body. Then she went into the kitchen, sat at the counter, and took another swallow from her beer can while toweling her hair. "In the course of this one day, several things have taken a decisive step forward," Almama thought. "The gears have turned forward with a click, and gears that have turned forward never turn back. That is one of the world's rules." Almama picked up the gun, turned it upside down, and put the muzzle into her mouth. The steel felt horrendously cold and hard against her teeth. She caught the faint scent of grease. "This is the best way to blow the brains out. Pull the hammer, squeeze the trigger. Everything ends just like that. No need to think. No need to run around." Almame was not particularly afraid of dying. "I die, Tango lives. He goes on living in this 1Q84, this world with 2 moons. But I'm not in it. I don't get to meet him in this world. Or any world.
At least that's what Leader says. Ah Mamet took another slow scan of the room.
It's like a model apartment, she thought. Clean and uniform with every need supplied. But distant and devoid of individuality. Papier-mâché. It wouldn't be very pleasant to die in a place like this. But even if you changed the backdrop to something more desirable, is there really a pleasant way to die in this world? And come to think of it, isn't this world we live in itself like a gigantic model room? We come in, sit down, have a cup of tea, gaze out the window at the scenery, and when the time comes, we say thank you and leave. All the furniture is fake. Even the moon hanging in the window may be made of paper. But I love tango. Ah, Mame murmured the words aloud. I love tango. This is no honky-tonk parade. 1Q84 is the real world, where a cut draws real blood, where pain is real pain and fear is real fear. The moon in the sky is no paper moon. It, or they, are real moons. And in this world, I have willingly accepted death for tango's sake. I won't let anyone call this fake. Al Mame looked at the round clock on the wall. A simple design by Braun, well matched to the Heckler & Koch. The clock was the only thing hanging on the walls of this apartment. The clock hands had passed 10. Just about time for the two men to find Leader's corpse. In the bedroom of an elegant suite at the Hotel Okura, a man had breathed his last. A big man. A man who was far from ordinary. He had moved on to another world. No one could do anything to bring him back. Time now for ghosts.
Chapter 16. Tango. Like a ghost ship. What kind of world will be there tomorrow? No one knows the answer to that, Fukaeri said. But the world to which Tango awoke did not appear especially changed from the world he had seen as he fell asleep the night before. The bedside clock said it was just after 6. Outside it was fully light, the air perfectly clear. A wedge of light came in through the curtains. Summer was winding down, it seemed. The cries of the birds were sharp and clear. Yesterday's violent thunderstorm felt like an apparition, or else something that had happened in an unknown place in the distant past. The first thing that came to Tengo's mind upon waking was that Fukaeri might have disappeared during the night. But no, there she was, next to him, sound asleep, like a little animal in hibernation. Her face was beautiful in sleep, a few narrow strands of black hair against her white cheek forming a complex pattern, her ears hidden. Her breathing was soft. Tango stared at the ceiling for a while, listening. Her breathing sounded like a tiny bellows. He retained a vivid tactile memory of last night's ejaculation. He had actually released semen, a lot of semen, inside this young girl. The thought made his head swim. But now that morning was here, it seemed as unreal as that violent storm, like something that happened in a dream. He had experienced wet dreams several times in his teens. He would have a realistic sexual dream, ejaculate, and then wake up. The events had all happened in the dream, but the release of semen was real. What he felt now was a lot like that. It had not been a wet dream, though. He had unquestionably come inside Fukaeri. She had deliberately penetrated herself with his penis and squeezed every drop of semen out of him. He had simply followed her lead. He had been totally paralyzed at the time, unable to move a finger. And as far as he was concerned, he was coming while in the elementary school classroom, not in Fukaeri, who later told him there was no chance she'd become pregnant because she had no periods. He couldn't fully grasp that such a thing had actually happened. But it had actually happened. As a real event in the real world. Probably. He got out of bed, got dressed, went to the kitchen, boiled water, and made coffee. While making the coffee, he tried to put his head in order, like arranging the contents of a desk drawer. He couldn't get things straight, though. All he succeeded in doing was rearranging the items in the drawer, putting the paper clips where the eraser had been, the pencil sharpener where the paper clips had been, and the eraser where the pencil sharpener had been, exchanging one form of confusion for another. After drinking a fresh cup of coffee, he went to the bathroom and shaved while listening to a Baroque music program on the FM radio, Telemann's Partitas for Various Solo Instruments. This was his normal routine: make coffee in the kitchen, drink it, and shave while listening to Baroque Music for You on the radio. Only the musical selections changed each day. Yesterday it had almost certainly been Rameau's keyboard music. The commentator was speaking.
Telemann won high praise throughout Europe in the early 18th century, but came to be disdained as too prolific by people in the 19th century. This was no fault of Telemann's, however. The purposes for which music is composed underwent great changes as the structure of European society changed, leading to this reversal in his reputation.
"Is this the new world?" he wondered. He took another look at his surroundings. Still, there was no sign of change. For now, there was no sign of disdainful people. In any case, what he had to do was shave. Whether the world had changed or not, no one was going to shave for him. He would have to do it himself. When he was through shaving, he made some toast, buttered and ate it, and drank another cup of coffee. He went into the bedroom to check on Fuka Eri, but she was still in a very deep sleep, it seemed. She hadn't moved at all. Her hair still formed the same pattern on her cheek. Her breathing was as soft as before. For the moment, he had nothing planned. He would not be teaching at the cram school. No one would be coming to visit, nor did he have any intention of visiting anyone. He could spend the day any way he liked. Tengo sat at the kitchen table and continued writing his novel, filling in the little squares on the manuscript paper with a fountain pen. As always, his attention became focused on his work. Switching channels in his mind made everything else disappear from his field of vision. It was just before 9 when Fuka Eri woke. She had taken off his pajamas and was wearing one of Tengo's t-shirts, the Jeff Beck Japan Tour t-shirt he was wearing when he visited his father in Chikura. Her nipples showed clearly through the shirt, which could not help but revive in Tengo the feeling of last night's ejaculation, the way a certain date brings to mind related historical facts. The FM radio was playing a Marcel Dupré organ piece. Tengo stopped writing and fixed her breakfast. Fuka Eri drank Earl Grey tea and ate strawberry jam on toast. She devoted as much time and care to spreading the jam on the toast as Rembrandt had when he painted the folds in a piece of clothing. "I wonder how many copies your book has sold," Tengo said.
"You mean Air Chrysalis?" Fuka Eri asked.
"Uh-huh."
"I don't know," Fuka Eri said, lightly creasing her brow. "A lot."
Numbers were not important to her, Tengo thought. Her "a lot" brought to mind clover growing on a broad plain as far as the eye could see. The clover suggested only the idea of a lot, but no one could count them all.
"A lot of people are reading Air Chrysalis," Tengo said.
Saying nothing, Fuka Eri inspected how well she had spread the jam on her toast.
"I'll have to see Mr. Komatsu as soon as possible," Tengo said, looking at Fuka Eri across the table. As always, her face showed no expression.
"You have met Mr. Komatsu, haven't you?"
"At the press conference."
"Did you talk?"
Fuka Eri gave her head a slight shake, meaning they had hardly talked at all. Tengo could imagine the scene vividly. Komatsu was talking his head off at top speed, saying everything he was thinking or not thinking, while she hardly opened her mouth or listened to what he had to say. Komatsu was not concerned about that. If anyone ever asked Tengo for a concrete example of two perfectly incompatible personalities, he would name Fuka Eri and Komatsu. Tengo said, "I haven't seen Mr. Komatsu for a very long time, and I haven't heard from him either. He must be very busy these days. Ever since Air Chrysalis became a bestseller, he's been swept up in the circus. It's about time, though, for us to get together and have a serious talk. We've got all kinds of problems to discuss. Now would be a good chance to do that, since you're here. How about it? Want to see him together?"
"The three of us?"
"Uh-huh.
That'd be the quickest way to settle things. Fukaeri thought about this for a moment, or else she was imagining something. Then she said, I don't mind, if we can.